You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On September 7, 2009, scientists working for the Chemical Abstract Service, which assigns identification numbers to all new chemicals, entered the 50 millionth chemical substance into their registry. It took the CAS 33 years to register the first 10 million substances, but the last 10 million chemicals were registered in just the past 9 months at a rate of 29 new substances every minute.
25
new. Is that what I said?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Our favorite chemist and industrial hygienist, Manona Russell, joins me now to explain why this proliferation of new chemicals is occurring and what it might mean for our health. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you.
I don't remember seeing this story in the newspapers. Was it covered by the press?
Well, very lightly, but I read it first in the Chemical and Engineering News. I'm, of course, a member of the American Chemical Society, and that's one of their publications. I probably read about 4 hours a day, so I do see things that other people don't.
What is the Chemical Abstract Service? Is it a government agency or a professional organization?
No, it's a branch of the American Chemical Society. It started in, I think, 1965. And what they wanted to do was every time they found a unique chemical, a new chemical, listed in any scientific paper or whatever, they would then register it, give it a number. That number doesn't mean anything except now you have a database to go to. You don't want to be calling the poison control, for example, and pronouncing methyl ethyl death. What you want to do is look for that CAS number. You give that to the poison control. Now, they come up with the right chemical.
But it must be hard getting through 50 million different substances.
Yeah, there's a lot of numbers.
Why are so many new substances being created right now?
Well, of course, nanotechnology is absolutely blossoming. So a lot of these are nanochemicals. And also, it's my belief, and this I have no scientific proof of this, but since Europe said you've got to test 30,000 chemicals, and if you haven't done the testing by 2012, you can't use them in our market of 450 million people, I think that manufacturers really want to get a whole lot of lookalike chemicals. I think, you know, they take a complex chemical that does a particular job. You could stick a little methyl group on it or some other thing. It'll probably function pretty much the same, but it will have the same properties. So they can replace them and say, well, now this is an untested chemical.
But would it be any safer?
No. That's the real problem. There is absolutely no reason to believe that any of these chemicals are safe. And being created at the rate of 25 a minute, there is no way you're testing for anything.
So most of these chemicals are being designed in industry, not in academia or by research scientists.
Well, that's the interesting point. The first 10 million that they registered came almost exclusively from scientific papers. That's why it was called the Chemical Abstract Service, because an abstract is a summary of a paper, and you could get those abstracts by going to that service. But these were primarily from patent offices. So these are already meant for a purpose, and the other big chunk of them came from actual chemical catalogs. So they're out there.
What are most of the new substances being registered? Are they mostly chemicals being used in manufacturing commercial products?
Well, see, we really don't know. There's no way to know. When you see a Chemical Abstract Service number, it does tell you about what you can get the structure, you know what it is. But what it's being used for is nobody's business.
And we have no idea whether it's going to be found in the marketplace anytime soon?
No. No, but the fact that they're in chemical catalogs tells me that they probably are.
Well, of these 50 million chemicals, how many might be found in products commonly used in our homes and offices?
Absolutely no way to know.
The EPA says there are 6,000 chemicals found in general use, and the European Union says 140,000. Why is there such a large discrepancy
in
the numbers?
Well, you know, you see all of these people, you will see people affirmatively saying there are 70,000 chemicals, there are 80,000, there's... Well, they asked EPA back a few years ago how many chemicals are actually in commerce. And they said, well, how should we know? Because they don't register them. So they made some guesses based on the number of chemicals that are listed in the Toxic Substance Control Act and a few things. They made some stabs at it. But in Europe, if you don't register the chemicals in your product, you can't sell the product. So they actually register them.
Still, there's a big gap between 140,000, the higher European number, and 50 million.
Well, yes. So it's really questionable now. You see, since the European Union keeps on registering more chemicals, it probably isn't going to stop at 140,000. So if you're a manufacturer and you don't have the testing on one of the high-volume chemicals that is in one of your products by 2012, you've got a huge number of chemicals to pick from to substitute.
So of all the chemicals that we have in common usage, how many have been tested? Have they all been tested?
No, almost none. It's just minuscule. There's only 900 chemicals worldwide that have even been looked at for cancer. I mean, so if you're talking 50 million or 140,000 or even the 6,000 that are in common use today in products that we know of, 900 only have even been tested for cancer.
Well, how can you even test for cancer? It's a long-term
situation. It's a two-year study. And, yeah, so it's not going to happen. These chemicals are just going to keep coming out until somebody puts a halt to it, until somebody says, and it's got to be you and I, who say, hey, wait a minute, test it before you put it in our product.
Well, who's doing the testing in the first place? I'm assuming that the industry is doing its own testing, and we've seen problems in the past when that sort of thing happens.
No, they won't test unless they're forced to. And there are no laws really forcing them to. If it's a brand new chemical and it's in a class that people are worried about, EPA supposedly has the authority to set up what's called a SNR, a significant new use rule, where they will require certain tests. The fact of the matter is they've only required testing on 158 chemicals, and of those, only 169 were actually tested.
Are they testing just for cancer? What about other problems?
No, that's important, and that's why the European tests are so good. They're testing for endocrine disruption. That's actually a rather quick test. That can be done on cell lines. And they are testing for cancer, but they're also testing for birth defects and for other types of toxicity, organ system damage, and so on.
My guest is chemist and industrial hygienist Manona Russell. We're talking about the proliferation of new substances being created. What we said 25 being registered every minute. By God. And you mentioned the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, as the organization that in theory oversees all of this. What about the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission?
Well, it's going to do a better job, I think, than it did before, because we have a new administration where actually people think the agencies may have some purpose. But they only look at consumer products and only certain ones. I mean, a lot of people will say, well, the Consumer Product Safety Commission must be doing a good job. I've seen all those recalls of the lead jewelry for children and the lead in the lunch boxes and other things. And so, well, that was all forced on them by activists in California. Again, they didn't do much until they're kind of pushed.
And I would assume that they focus on certain things, foods, medicines, and products that are directed at children.
Yes, because their rules are very weak. There's only a handful of things that they actually have any control over. There's only a few banned substances, you know, like lead, cadmium, mercury under some circumstances.
Cyanide?
Cyanide. Yes, they can say something about cyanide. How nice.
Mm-hmm. Asbestos was once common. It's still all over the place, but it's banned now.
No, it's not.
No, it's not banned?
It's not banned at all. EPA tried to ban it. They put up a ban, and they said, that's it. We can't use it anymore. Industry took them to court, got it overturned. The judge said, well, you haven't determined what the cost to industry will be for this. And so they look at it from an economic point of view. So it's not banned. They were taken to court by a gasket company that uses it in gaskets. But now it's only certain very limited uses for which you can't put asbestos in. I think under the CPSC, you can't use it in fireplace logs, phony fireplace logs, or a few other things like that. But it's and you would have to label it if it was in a product.
What about heavy metals like lead and mercury? I noticed a couple of years ago, I don't know if it's still the case, that the flu shots they were administering contained thimerosal, which is mercury. And nobody was saying anything about that.
Well, a lot of people were, but the fact
only,
is...
Only parents of children with autism, but then the medical community dismisses their concerns.
Yeah, the amount of thimerosal was really very small, and we are exposed to much more from fish and from other things. So it's a question of how much of an influence that has. When it comes to those kinds of problems, neurological problems, I think we need to look at the consumer products, because right about 20 years ago when we suddenly saw these neurological things increasing, that's when you started seeing all these well-known neurological solvents like the glycol ethers and the petroleum distillates and so on. Those are in all of our products in large amounts where they were not in the past.
You're talking about in the plastics that we pack things in?
No, in the products that you would be concerned about in this instance, and that's what women use in the kitchen, what they use to clean, because that's where we're seeing those kinds of things. Those fast cleaners, those contain solvents.
All of them, the ones that we spray on our stove to
yes.
get rid of all of the tomato sauce that is
yeah,
stuck
unless
there.
unless it's a lye type. But if it's something that dissolves the grease with a solvent, then that's what we worry about, because those are known neurotoxins.
But they're miracle products.
Yeah,
I
got
can't
a
imagine
choice.
Living without them.
Faster problems, choose.
I guess I'll be scrubbing more in the
but
future.
Remember elbow grease? It was a good thing.
There are some states that have more stringent standards. But what does that mean? Does it mean it's safer for me to live in California than it is to live in New York?
Well, maybe not for other reasons. But in terms of products, yes. They have some very good laws. In fact, one of their laws applies to all of your consumer products as well. If you sell anything nationally in the United States, you still have to meet the California Proposition 65 law.
And what does the Prop 65 do?
It's beautiful. They sit down and they look at the data and they decide whether something is a carcinogen or not based on whatever little bit of studies there are. They don't wait for the last I to be dotted and the T to be crossed. If it looks like a cancer causer to them, they call it such, and they put it on their list. And then you have to label, you have to warn. It doesn't take anything off the market, but at least gives you a warning.
There's a citizens enforcement clause to Prop 65. What's that all about?
That is the key. If we really want to make a change, that will change it, because California's Proposition 65 not only doesn't cost California anything to enforce, they make money on it. If you put a citizens enforcement clause in an act, there's a list of penalties for breaking that law. If you then take somebody's product, take it to a lab, get a test, and can prove that it contains a Prop 65 chemical without the proper warning, you can take that information to the Attorney General, who will then pursue it, and you get part of the fine. If the Attorney General's office is too busy to do it, you can sue them and get all of the fines. So there are roving bands of lawyers going around enforcing Proposition 65, and it's easy to do.
I'm sure that the manufacturers are thrilled. What about other states? Have other states proposed similar laws?
They proposed them, but right after, there were, I think, six states that proposed it after Proposition 65 passed, and massive campaigns were set up in those states to make sure that didn't happen again.
Well, you can complain in California. What about on the federal level? What happens if I complain to the EPA or the CSPC?
Well, the EPA doesn't care about you as a consumer. You know, you haven't got much point to complain, because they're really looking at the environment primarily. If it damages the environment, if your neighbor is throwing something down their well or out into the street, yeah, the DEP might be interested. But the Consumer Product Safety Commission, if you want them to act, you usually have to end up petitioning them or getting a group together.
Well, a caller says the CPSC was defunded during the Reagan years. Has its funding been restored?
Well, they're looking at doing that. They've added some, but it really needs a lot of money. And if they really want to make it work, they could, again, cut the costs incredibly by making some of these things citizen enforced.
How did California come up with such a good law, or if we're going to consider it a good law? I'm sure there are people out there who think it's a terrible idea.
I know. It becomes a police state, they say. Well, yeah, better them than nothing happening, which is what we have now. The CPSC has an internal problem in that they work with manufacturers. Those recalls that you see, when you really look carefully on their website, you'll see most of them say, well, they're voluntarily recalled. Well, they put pressure on them to do it. But they don't really stand up and smack them on the side of the head and say, you can't do that anymore. That's rare. So they work too closely with the manufacturers.
My guest is Manona Russell, who's a chemist and an industrial hygienist and a regular contributor to our show. We invite your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm sure you have lots of questions. We will be back with more right after this. We're back with Manona Russell, who is a chemist and industrial hygienist, the president and founder of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, a nonprofit group. And we're talking about the proliferation of new chemicals that are being registered. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, released its fourth national report on human exposure to environmental chemicals. What did that report reveal?
Oh, that was wonderful. And it was just last week, so this is a well-timed broadcast. They looked at 212 chemicals that are known to be toxic in some way and measured them in urine and blood in 8,000 people. And we are carrying them. And they are things like PCBs and dioxins and mercury, bisphenol A that's been in the news a lot, that's from the plastics, acrylamide, which comes, by the way, when you just plain overcook or deep fry carbohydrates like French fries, you'll get acrylamide. It's also in some other products as well.
But some of those things sound to me like substances that have been regulated, that when, like PCBs, aren't they supposed to have been eliminated from the environment?
Well, no.
Did I pick them up before they were eliminated?
Well, yeah, see, the difficulty is whenever you burns something out in the backyard, or when there's a fire somewhere, you're going to have PCBs and dioxins created very often in those kinds of things. All the old caulks and paints contain them. We think of old caulks and paints as lead containing, but many of them also contain PCBs. So many of us are living with sources of these things. So even though they're not in new products, they're certainly in our environment.
Well, what about laws that ban lead in paint and in gasoline?
Though that's the good news of this study. It shows that when you ban things like that, the amount in the blood in people drops dramatically. The same with many of the chemicals that are found in cigarette smoke. The fact that we have gone so far to getting exposure both to cigarette smoke directly and secondhand smoke shows that many of those chemicals are significantly reduced. So it is a matter of legislation.
So it did show up in the report that where secondhand smoke, the impact of secondhand smoke has been lessened?
Yes, and they're doing it again by testing what's in our bodies, which is the best way to do it. And this is the fourth annual report. So they have been doing this since 1999, so they have seen the changes over time.
A listener left a comment on our show page saying, I was just reading in the Times about the proliferation of cancerous chemicals that are not even tested by the Clean Drinking Water Law because they were developed after that law was passed. Short of running it through a reverse osmosis system, is there any way that one can be sure the water we're drinking, tap or bottle, is clean?
No, that's the difficulty. So the reverse osmosis is one of the best ways. But a simple Brita filter will take out a lot of organics, and it will do pretty well with lead. So you can, even in New York here, help yourself to some extent. But guaranteeing that these things are not there in any amount, no.
Now, this report that we're talking about, the CDC report, is the fourth since 1999.
Right.
Did the numbers really add up? I mean, are we seeing major changes over the years, positive or negative?
Well, the positive ones are in the areas where we've banned things. But we are still seeing a very slow reduction in PCBs and dioxin because they are fat soluble. And so if you eat fish, if you, you know, it just keeps on recycling in the environment.
The last time you were here, we talked a lot about the cleaning products that you mentioned a little while ago. Why don't we talk about another product found in most homes, house paint? Are water-based house paints safe?
Well, they were actually more toxic when they first came out.
Are they better than oil paints, the latex paints?
Well, you see, the oil paints contain solvents. Their solvent was their carrier. So you could get high as a kite painting. I mean, you could really hurt yourself painting if you didn't have good ventilation. But and they did very often contain lead back then, too. So you had a lot of problems with those. But when the new water-based paints came out, many of them were not solvent-free. They contained very toxic glycol ethers that absorb through the skin, can be inhaled, are reproductive hazards. And mercury was a big preservative in these paints because the acrylic emulsion will support the growth of bacteria and fungi. The paints will just get eaten up in the can or on your walls if you don't have some kind of preservative. So some of these early paints contained a lot of mercury.
The label often lists only 5 or 6 ingredients. You say there are a lot more.
Yeah, and the basis for that is I subscribe to the Journal of Coatings, Paint and Coatings Technology. It's the industry talking to itself, and I've been doing that for many years. And so I know the vast number of chemicals that go into those kinds of paints, and the basic reason is simple. Plastic is hydrophobic. It doesn't like water. It does not want to bead up and stay in a nice little liquid droplet inside the paint until you put it on the wall, and then as the water dries, fuse into a nice, neat layer. So to make plastics do that takes an awful lot of chemicals. So there,
but they're not listed. Why shouldn't they be listed? Doesn't the law require listing of all chemicals?
No, but from your lips to God's ears, I'd like to see the whole schmear on there. But they are mostly considered trade secrets. The emulsions are trade secrets. So you will only see the basic chemicals in there. You won't see the small amounts.
Well, now that we have cut back on mercury as a preservative, what are we using?
Oh, there's a whole lot of different chemicals. That's another whole subject.
Are they an improvement?
Some of them, there's very little data, actually, for long term. You would think, being a preservative or basically a pesticide, that there would be a lot of data on it, but some of them, there isn't that much.
Are there some colors that are better than others? For example, is white paint likely to be safer than blue or green or red?
No, because they're all going to contain, if you get one brand of paint, it's going to contain the same basic white in it. It's usually going to be titanium dioxide or a silicate or a carbonate or something. But that's the basis. The colors in house paints are gotten from tinting chemicals, and most of those are organic chemicals. You can buy the blue and the green, and they mix them in and shade the paint. So they're going to be just added to that basic white.
Are paints required to list all the ingredients in Europe?
No. No, again, they usually have a cutoff because can you imagine the label with 40 ingredients?
Yes.
And most of them with the name as long as your arm, because some of those are very odd chemicals. And a chemical name for a dye can go on for a page.
Well, that's always been a concern of mine. When I see too many of those long chemical names, I'm less likely to buy something. But in some cases, I have no choice in the matter.
Oh, yeah, you don't.
My guest is Monona Russell, who is the president and founder of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, a nonprofit group. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about plastics, which are used in pretty much everything these days? Are they are there better and worse types of plastics? And since we've heard all sorts of safety concerns about some plastics, are we improving the situation?
Well, at least we have more scrutiny. For some reason, that area of commerce has caught the consumer's interest. Because all of our stuff comes in plastic, and we put the plastic in the microwave, and we, you know, store our stuff in plastic in the refrigerator. So we've become aware that even though it looks nice and clear and pure, it isn't pure anything. There's all kinds of other stuff in there, chemicals coming off. And we have got some legislation now where you can look at that little triangle, that recycling triangle, look at the number and actually look up the actual chemical and find out which ones you think are safer.
Well, in one of his recent columns in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof wrote that we should avoid using plastics with the numbers 3, 6, and 7 in the microwave or dishwasher, but ones labeled 1, 2, 4, and 5 are okay.
Well, that's the general view, I'm just a little tiny bit more jaded because some of those also, those safe ones also I would have problems with, and especially any plastic that gets slightly overheated.
A listener left a comment on our show page saying, I've read that cancer patients should never use anything washed in dishwasher detergent. But first of all, I don't know if that's true, but how about brands like Seventh Generation or E-Cover?
Oh, dear. That is such a... You know, when you go into the food aisle in the grocery store and it says organic, you at least know, well, says who. We got to be kids again. Says who. You want to look carefully at the companies that are claiming green and get their material safety data sheets and other information and be very canny because their views very often... Are based on EPA regulations instead of safety regulations. They're looking at what's good for the environment. The environment is not you. So some of the natural solvents like citrus oil are extremely toxic to people. So you have to look, first of all, what their philosophy really is and how much are they telling you? Are they really listing everything that's in there?
Citrus oil in dishwasher detergent?
Yeah, it's very common in dishwashing liquids now.
That's the thing that says lemon-flavored?
Yeah, lemon. Well, if it's just a tiny bit for odor, I really don't have too much of a problem, although it's not that good. But the real rind oil from citrus fruit is an EPA-registered pesticide. And it is a very, if you want a biodegradable pesticide, it's a good substance. But you don't want to be rubbing it on your hands, putting a whole lot of it in your dishwater, letting it evaporate into the air.
Well, there's I've been told that dishwasher detergent is a lot harsher than any other soap that we might use. Why is that?
That's not true. If the laundry detergents, you have to look at what chemicals are in them, which soaps there are. And we've got to remember this is, again, complicated because there's probably 20, 30 basic kinds of cleaning materials. And so, you know, if anyone has a real question about a particular product, if they want to send me the material safety data sheet, I'll evaluate it for them.
What about food additives? There's one, now I'm never sure how to pronounce it, diacetyl?
Well, that's a story that everyone ought to know because it gives a really important principle. This is a chemical that can be isolated from butter. It's what gives it the nice buttery taste. And they found out the buttery taste didn't have to do with all the fats and oils in the butter. It had to do with diacetyl.
So I can't believe it's not butter uses diacetyl?
Yes. These are the kinds of things where they isolated this chemical and they added it back in large amounts so things taste more buttery and so on.
Popcorn?
That's where the big story came. They were putting a lot of it in microwave popcorn. The workers who were making this stuff started to develop a very rare disease, and bronchiolitis obliterans. They literally were wrecking their lungs. Some of them have had lung transplants. It's a potentially fatal disease. And yet this is a chemical that is not known for being hazardous. It's in common products. The real issue here is don't snort your food. Look at the route of entry. Some things.
If we eat it, it's okay, but if we breathe it in, it's not
fine.
Good?
If you breathe it, it's bad. The same with mineral oil. If you take a whole lot of mineral oil, it'll go through you just like grass through a goose. But if you inhale it, you can get lipoid pneumonia and die.
Now, a lot of people are concerned about any product that comes out of China. Should we be?
Yes. Yes, I guess I can really say that. I have been reading...
I love the way you mince words.
I've been reading the memorandums of understanding that our government has been signing with the Chinese government for about 30 years. And we sign the same agreements over and over, and they still don't do what they're supposed to. I'm especially aware of the areas of ceramics because that's one of my fields. the amount of lead and other chemicals that can leach out of ceramics. But it's just, it's a very big country, and it doesn't have the quality control that we would like.
A listener named Steve wonders whether you have a comment about the toxicity of car interiors.
Well, you know, you sit down in that new car, and it's soft seat, and it's a nice, oh, beautiful pad, nice dashboard. And there's that smell, that new car smell. Well, that's phthalates. That's phthalates. They're endocrine disruptors. And sometimes there's so much phthalate coming out of those plastics that in the winter they'll condense on the windows, and you can actually feel the greasy phthalates.
So what do? We have these plastics in our cars. You go to a supermarket, and pretty much everything is wrapped in plastic, and we understand why. It keeps it fresher. Is there a way to get around all of this? And then we take it home, and we don't want it to go bad, and we stick it in a plastic bag or a plastic container?
I think you have to take a deep breath and realize that you are never going to get away from all of this stuff and accept it. And from there, start making good choices. If you can use the plastics with the good numbers instead of the bad, do it. If you can eat better food, then do it. Do all those things that you already know, and then start learning more so that you can add some things to that. But don't get crazy about it, because we're all in this boat and it's sinking.
So when I have a plastic bag that says microwave safe, I should assume it really is microwave safe?
Well, at least we know that the major things are not coming out. But wouldn't it be better to buy some fruit or vegetable at the store and go home and cook it? You know, that's the way you have to start thinking, instead of the fast bag that you throw in the boiling water.
Manona Russell is a chemist and an industrial hygienist, the president and founder of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, a nonprofit group. And she'll be answering questions that you leave on our show page. Our show page is at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us again, Manona. It's always fascinating. And as I said, it's always great to have a guest who doesn't mince words.
Thank you. It's always fun.